But I'm going to be doing those like PEP 101, like old steps, like as long as
organic
I do
organic releases. Lucas Blanga does organic releases. Oh, no, yes. Not this like new age shit, like, you know, automated. No, organic.
Yes, certified biological by the European Union. PEP 101, like, is something. You need to read it. Like, first of all, you need to Google and not press the first result, because it's some Australian HIV, program. Pablo's first release actually was interesting, because that was like a pivotal moment for Python that never happened in the history of Python before.
I'm also maintaining other projects like Pillar and like 10 or 20 other packages. And it's been interesting there to kind of improve the release process.
In 3.10, I think I reverted the same thing 6 times.
What does a Python release manager actually do? This is a conversation I had with 3 Python core developers: Lucas Langa, Pablo Galindo Salgado, and Hugo Van Kemenade. Lucas and Pablo have been release managers in the past, while Hugo is the current one. Lucas works at the Python Software Foundation, Pablo at Bloomberg, and Hugo at the Sovereign Tech Agency. We talked about what really happens behind the scenes of a release, the trickiest ones they have faced, how they even got into this role, and the fun little rituals such as YouTube release party they did.
Lucas, you were the release manager of Python 3.8, 3.9, Pablo 3.10, 3.11, and Hugo 3.14 and 3.15. Mm-hmm. Whose release was the least successful one?
Who wants to pick this up?
It wasn't mine. Not yet.
It was no. I did it. No. It was not mine either. Mine. Okay. So I have. We have to establish some rules to judge this, because like I destroy GitHub as part of my release process.
That's quite a good.
Is that good? Yeah. Is that successful?
I want to hear that story.
So in 3.10, it was 3.10, no? So in 3.10, we were in charge of We renamed the master branch to main. So GitHub has this beautiful kind of like super cool process when you're supposed to just, you know, click the button like do it. But turns out that do it worked for like, you know, repos with like 100 issues or something. But like we are kind of a big whale. And the moment actually is recorded. I say something like, wouldn't it be fun if this breaks GitHub? And then immediately broke GitHub. And, you know, it was fun on the stream because I was recording this live at the time. But then the thing I think it was not clear is that we were in a back channel with GitHub, and the thing was on fire because apparently it was some kind of like a Ruby, like queue something that they supposed to migrate all their forks. And like it was too much and it was destroying the thing. And like actually all the repos were 500 because of the queue. So if someone was changing from master to main at the same time, it was blowing up. So yeah, we kind of caused a big outage. But is that unsuccessful? I wouldn't say that.
No, it's like we stress test lots of things, don't we? Like we often find bugs in compilers when working on CPython, and we found bugs in GitHub too.
So is it successful?
Yeah.
I would say that's successful. The unsuccessful ones that we've had, and I've had a bunch of those, like Hugo will have a bunch of those, and Pablo also had a bunch of those, is like the micro releases that we identify have something seriously wrong with them. So that happens every now and again, and then you have to have like a hotfix release that is out of schedule. You just have to say whoopsie and just go ahead and do another one really quickly. So there's been some of those where we broke ABI compatibility and it's like, no, we need to just release another one. What fortunately happens more often is that a failed release fails during the release. So before it actually goes out to people, at some point in our testing, of which we have many levels, we identify like, this actually doesn't work so well. We need to start over. Like we need to do a fix and actually do the entire thing again. But yeah, there's been a few where we identify not one, not two, but like 3 regressions. And in quick succession, like we had to just like do another release with those fixes. So we've just done this year.
And did it cause any delays?
We sort of set our own schedule. Like this is based on like PEP 602 that says like every year getting a new Python in October. But the details of it, like what the particular day we are doing a particular thing, like it's up to the release manager to put in the release schedule for a particular Python version, like 3.14 right now. And like delays would be like you plan for this to happen on a Monday or Tuesday, and well, you cannot do it. Like you're going to do it on Thursday, maybe Friday. And those are usually stressful days because we're not sitting on our hands during those days, but like actually trying like to fix the regression or revert it. But sometimes it's not easy to revert it because it's already covered by a bunch of other changes and so on and so on. So I wouldn't say delays, we set the time, but sometimes it is not a matter of like automation, of which we have a lot, but like actually just doing the work to allow for a release.
So you mentioned scheduling. What are all the things that release managers actually do behind the scenes? Hugo?
Well, let's see. The main task of the release manager is to ensure that the quality of the release is, you know, up to scratch, because lots of people use Python and depend on it. So we don't want everything to suddenly break for people in a bad way. So that's kind of the main thing, is to like check that there's no, you know, bad things going in there.
Has it changed throughout the years? What was the difference between like release of 3.09, for example, and between the release nowadays?
Yes.
Is there any improvements?
Yes, yes. So when I started to be release manager, I inherited this horrible state of the art from Gukis Slanga, because like basically the releases are, well, now I don't know, maybe it's better but with the time, but like there is a big PEP, I think it's PEP 101. Mm-hmm. PEP 101. So PEP 101 that was initially written by Larry Hastings, if I'm not incorrect.
I think Barry.
Or Barry, well, the old guard. And like it's quite so that basically has all the steps that you need to write. It's like a recipe. It's kind of a bit weird as well, because like I think it was Larry leave like a bunch of like stop now, and like the idea is that you could search for those points and like that. So it was like very bespoke. And when I arrived there, and I did it once for some like the first alpha maybe, I said I'm not doing this by hand. Like this is horrible. So I created this script called run release. That was like automating this, and it's kind of like it's an interesting exercise on DevOps, because it's not that easy to automate. Like you need to SSH to servers, you need to copy things from the servers, you need to run things on the servers. Also, like it's very likely that your process fails because random stuff. So you don't want to restart from the start just because your script crashes in the middle. So there is checkpoints. So I try to automate as much as possible. And after that, I think like the rest of like Thomas and Hugo like have been improving that. And now we actually run on GitHub Actions most of the process, because that was something that Seth did, our security developer in residence. And the reason is because before we were running most of the release on our computers, which, you know, we like them a lot and we keep them clean and whatnot and safe. But you know, you could argue that you don't trust us. We are not that trustworthy. So now at least the build part runs in GitHub Actions, which you could argue that is reproducible, and like, you know, that people can see it happening and whatnot.
That was actually a surprise for me. So before I became release manager, I looked at PEP 101, and it's a huge PEP. There's so much detail there. But then at the core sprint in Brno, was it 2 years ago or something? Thomas was making a release at the same time, and he said, if anyone wants to see the process, just sit next to him. So I watched it. It's like, oh, actually, it's not as bad as this whole PEP 101. So we should really, you know, update that whole thing. But this is like, these are the manual steps if all our automation disappeared.
Humanity just is destroyed, and there is no computers, and people want to know how we release the Python.
Yeah.
They have the recipe.
We can actually probably just truncate this PEP like by a lot, but not yet, because I didn't quite trust Pablo's automation for my own releases, since like those were like very old. Like Python 3.8 is now end of life, like it's no longer released, and Python 3.9 is going to probably see like maybe one or two more before it goes end of life this October. So like for this, I still use the caveman PEP and like the previous scripts, of which like a lot was already sort of automated, but like just a particular step. There was no like checkpointing system to do like the entire process. And it turned out that like that actually massaging this like large like big boy release automation, like that took a few releases, right? Like that took like a few years like to get to the point where it doesn't crash in the middle and now you're like, oh, I don't actually know where to go from here. So you know, it is great now. Like it allows us to do GitHub Actions and whatever. But just so that people don't get the wrong idea, like, yeah, I do have my own sort of like pristine Ubuntu VM for the 3.9 releases. They're only security. They don't have any installers anymore. Like they're just source releases. But I'm going to be doing those like PEP 101, like old steps, like as long as
organic
I do.
Organic releases. Lucas Blanga does organic releases. Not this like new age shit, like, you know, automated. No, organic releases.
Yes, certified biological by the European Union. Yes, certified bio.
And are there any things that surprised you when you inherited the old release process?
Yeah, well, PEP 101 like is something. You need to read it. Like, first of all, you need to Google and not press the first result because it's some Australian HIV, program, like, you know, whatever. And it's like, whoa, cool. Like, you need to be really careful about there. Like, you go to PEP 101 and it is a super long PEP. There's a lot of like, you know, you log into this machine, copy files over from here to there, making sure that, you know, permissions are correct and whatever. So yeah, like the sort of process had more steps than I thought. So now that the fact that they are automated is great. What does help me is knowing that like, even if there's automation for stuff like for other branches, like I did release a bunch of like other branches as well when I had to like step in, you know, somebody was unavailable. So I did those releases like with the automation. So I at least I know what the steps are from PEP 101 because I did so many like, you know, of my own manually. So if something goes wrong, I know, okay, like, you know, you actually had expected this to happen. Pablo's first release actually was interesting because that was like a pivotal moment for Python that never happened in the history of Python before, where the second digit, the second number had two digits now. So 3.10, like it turns out that a ton of like scripts, a ton of code, a ton of infrastructure just did not expect that there's going to be 3.2 digits now. And like that took some fixing.
And how does the schedule work? So if I submit a hotfix, for example, or a bug fix, how do you decide what goes into which release?
So we have different types of release. So right now, the main branch is for Python 3.15, which will be released in October next year. So all new features go into there, and we'll start doing alpha releases for that in May next year. And right now we have 3.14 is the forthcoming one. So no more features are allowed in there. The cutoff for that was in May as well. And so there we only have bug fixes coming in, which will be then released in October. Then for the older releases, we have some which are in bug fix only. They are, it's just 3.13, it's 3.12, no. 3.13
only.
Yeah. It's only 3.13. And then we have a few which are security now. So that's 3.9 up to 3.12. So they only get security fixes. So we hardly ever merge anything into them branches because it's only like security. And then the bug fix releases, then we make a release for them every 2 months. But the security is kind of on demand whenever we think that, okay, this is now time to do something.
Were there any changes in the past or it was exactly the same?
Well, like when I started, the releases were like every 18 months-ish, but there was no actual calendar of releases, which was pretty problematic for upstream, kind of distributors. Well, for downstream distributors like Linux distributions, because they never knew like where a new Python version would appear. So very often a new Linux version would have like Ubuntu or Debian or Red Hat would have like a pretty old Python. And that was before, because there was no synchronization between the calendars and, you know, they had to just take whatever it was stable at the time. Worse yet, we didn't even know ourselves. So like 18 months often actually end up ended up being like almost 24 months. So there were just like many changes in like that you can gather in like 2 years, right? So like I wrote like PEP 602 to just make sure that like we are synchronized with the Linux distributions, and Fedora like now could always pick up the latest Python version developed that year. So for that same year, like they had like the latest version. Ubuntu did the same. Not sure if they're still doing it. Like I haven't checked like lately, but like that's why we have done the annual releases. And it actually, it works very well with our conferences and the annual core sprint week and so on. So like, you know, actually having all of that is like, I guess, like a stable rhythm that people just enjoy. I don't think this is going to be changing.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It's predictable. So you know when it's coming out. And like just with like 314, 50, 315, you kind of know when the cutoffs are. It's like May for the alpha to beta and stuff like that. And
I think it's also great for contributors because like before, if you make a, like a good feature and you want to show everyone or like use it yourself, like it was 2 years, right? Like that's a bit soul crushing. Even today it's a bit soul crushing. Like we have very recently to say to some contributors that were very excited to get something on 314 that, hey, like no, like you need to wait a year and like 2 months or 3 months, right? But now it's just, a year is still out of time, but like it's a bit more palatable than just, you know, like 2 years, which is like a lot.
Do you ever get angry messages from people expecting something to be merged?
All the time. Yeah.
Actually, the release manager has this ability to like revert a thing. So if you're like, there is a feature, somebody's really proud of it, but like then we identify well and it crashes just sometimes. So like we give people some time to like, you know, please fix it. So they try, they poke at it and whatever, but like it's just not working. At some point the release manager has to say like, well, we're going to be doing a release soon. So how about this? I'm going to revert your thing. You can work on it still, but like, it's not going to land in this release. And you would think that people get emotional about this, but like my experience was that usually not. Like people are understanding like, okay, the release needs to go through and, you know, okay, we can fix it later on and reapply the change when we already know that it's of better quality.
So in 3.10, I think I reverted the same thing 6 times. Not 6 times, one on top of the other, obviously, like Robert, try again. And like, you know, the person in particular was like very chill, like, I mean, understanding. But yeah, like part of the job is being a bit of a cat herder, let's say. So you know, like you need to tell people no. You need to know that if you make an exception for someone, then you need to make an exception probably for more people. So like the first exception is a bit tricky, at least in my experience. And then you need to constantly judge, you know, like, okay, this change is compromising the release. Because sometimes, let's say the standard is different for different people. I mean, we all have a high standard, but like, you know, release manager must have the highest standard. Sometimes it's not cutting it and you need to say, well, you know, this looks good, but like, it's not really as good as it should. So like, you know, you either fix it now or like we need to trip it out. And, you know, you become the Grinch of it and you need to be ready for that. So it's not a job to make friends.
I heard actually with Kubernetes, the release manager there, if the feature's been merged but the documentation isn't there by some deadline, they will revert the feature. So, for example, now T-Strings is merged, but the documentation isn't there. So, if we did the same...
It will be reverted.
Yeah, revert that.
Revert T-String.
We don't have that policy, though. No. Not yet.
Not yet, huh? Well, like, every release manager, like, kind of adheres to the same general rules, but like, yeah, the flavor differs. So, you know, kind of you're going to have different interactions, different willingness to like, you know, kind of bend the rules. Like, okay, I'm going to like let you commit your feature like on beta 2 because, okay, like look sensible. Other people are going to be like, no, it's just, you know, it's just too risky, whatever. So like, this is why the kind of selection of a release manager is sort of like a demonstration of trust, right? Because like you need to like just think that like that particular person will not just do something weird that like is going to like put like Python in a situation where we need to do more hotfix releases. Hopefully this is a very rare occurrence.
So you mentioned trust. It's very important for the community and for core developers to trust the release manager to be able to make the best decision. So how does one become a release manager?
Secret.
The secret cabal discusses. We kind of look for someone who's interested and hope that they will volunteer and then commit the next 7 years of their life basically to doing 2 releases.
I mean, we are changing this a bit because like the process has been a bit obscure, let's say, and we are trying to move towards more open processes these days. So the release manager mail is literally called cabal@python.org, right? So
there's no such
thing. There's no such. Okay. Sorry, mm-hmm.
So no, basically, one person volunteers and the team says yes.
Yes, or sometimes, like, so for instance, it changes as well depending on the current release manager. Like, what I did, for example, was to ask for volunteers first. So, like, I sent an email saying, like, okay, you know, like, it's time for a new release manager.
Have you found any?
Yeah. I mean, at the time, I had already people, but I'm very annoying with this, and I believe, like, you know, everybody should have the same blah, blah, blah. But like, that's not a requirement, right? So for now, like normally there is one or two candidates that were already interested. Like for instance, Hugo here was saying that in the corner there's been Bernard, he was shadowing Thomas doing the release because he was interested already. So like Thomas knew, okay, Hugo, you know, and if you stick around and it is only one person, normally it's that person. If there is many, then it's a different thing. So now we still don't have this finalized. Literally we are talking about this as we speak, but like we are talking about involving the steering council a bit more, not particularly so the steering council chooses, but like so the same way the working groups that we have will make suggestions to the steering council and the steering council ratifies just to ensure that everything looks good, a similar way the release managers will make a suggestion and the steering council checks. Like this is important because we want to ensure that the process is fair and like we have diversity in the candidates as well, and like it's not just like because release manager choosing the next release manager can feel a bit endogamic, right? But it's important because they will know who makes a good release manager. As we can see, it's not a trivial thing. But we want to involve some kind of like external entity that can ratify this a bit more, so ensure that we are not like, you know, and it's a conversation. So they are not going to just say, no, not that candidate, you know? So it's just like, okay, have you think about this? Or like, what if this or that? But we are still figuring that out. Yeah.
So if you have more candidates, do you have some formal vote or do you just agree?
Right, like, essentially, it comes down to, you know, people just sharing their opinion on, like, which candidate they would rather have. Because the trust component isn't about, like, oh, like, is your moral spine to my standard? Like, it's you know, obviously, like, you need to feel that, like, okay, that member, like, new member of the team, like, I can trust that person to do the right thing. Like, but the trust component is, like, much larger. It is responsibility that you are requiring from somebody, like, for 6 years, right? Because, like, it's 5 years per release, but the second one is going to only start, like, a year from now. So
then it's also another year because you have 17 months of pre-release.
Right. So, yes. Yeah. Yes. So like, you know, so like, right. So it is a very long time commitment. So the trust component is really looking at like, you know, does this person look like their life is in a place where we can, because it's a little unreasonable. Those are volunteers. Like we can expect them to be around for like 7 years, right? It's a long time. Like a lot can change in somebody's life in that time frame. So you know, kind of, we are considering different aspects there. Like you know, it might be like a little like you know, okay, you know, you're looking at my, well, I don't know, work history or whatever, where I live or whatever. But you need to sort of know that this person is not going to disappear halfway through, because like it is, as we discussed, not only about pushing the button and the automation, but there is a lot of decisions that are being made about like changes that didn't work out so well. And what then, you know, or, oh, you just barely missed the calendar. And what then? So you want continuity for a given release and somebody who remembers that, oh, this code, which is getting increasingly older, like I still have like a pretty good understanding in my head, like at which stage 3.9 is versus what we have in main. This comes into place when you have security only releases and you need to think about how far those things can be backported. Like some backports are just not reasonable to make, but some have to be, even if they're very hard, because security like is paramount. So, you know, kind of all of the selection, all I'm saying is that, you know, the entire team previous release managers on this mailing list that does not exist, the release managers there like go all the way back. There's like all release managers are part of this mailing list, so they can voice their opinion, like concerns or like support for a particular candidate and so on.
And have you ever had the case that someone disappeared, got hit by a bus or something happened and you had to replace your release manager?
I vaguely recall that there was some change like a long time ago in the history of Python, like, but I don't even recall the details or who that was. All I know is that there was one particular unlucky release manager who signed up for Python 2.7. And it turned out to be a gig that he, at the time he stopped doing it, he was doing for half his life. He was a young release manager, and Python 2.7 lived for very many years and was maintained for a long, long time before we transitioned fully to Python 3. So I'm pretty sure Benjamin did not expect to do it for so long, but he did. Like all of that time, he was very dependable and available.
When I made the release schedule for 3.14, which is PEP 745, so I put all the dates for the pre-releases, but then you also put, which will be supported until end of life in October 2030. And that was the first time I saw that year in black and white and realized that I'm committing myself to work on this, you know.
So what motivated you to volunteer for that role?
It kind of did look quite interesting because I'm also maintaining other projects like Pillow and like 10 or 20 other packages. And it's been interesting there to kind of improve the release process. Because when you can release easily, then you can just get things out to people much more quickly. There are some projects where they have fixes, but they've not released for a long time. Mm-hmm. And people are kind of waiting for it. And it's like, well, you've already done the work and why not get it to people? So like things like Trusted Publishing now is very good. So you can just release all in the CI. With Pillow, we used to have a process where the Windows wheels were built by someone in California. So I'd do the release, start it, we'd make the tag, I'd make the Linux wheels and Mac ones, and then contact the guy in California, say, could you do the Windows wheels? Then I wait for him to wake up, you know, 10 hours later or something, and then he'll make them and then finish off. So improving processes like that is kind of quite rewarding, I think.
What was your motivation? Was it the same or did you have any different one?
I mean, my motivation was to, because like I see how the process was done. And I said like, this is horrible. I this is disgusting. Like, so I will fix it. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. It's like, I suppose like when you're in this kind of community, like you're always looking for ways to be useful, right? And like, you know, you not only need to find things that make you happy, but like you to find ways that you can maximize your impact, right? And this job, even if it sounds like, ooh, release manager, you know, like who, that sounds important. No, I mean, it's like, you know, glorify cat herder, right? Again. So, but a lot of like, what happens normally is that people don't want to do it because it's 5 years, you need to be there. Like, and you know, now the release happens when the release happens. I have made releases in the plane, right? Or like my way to a wedding or something, right? So, you know, it's a responsibility and, you know, it's a responsibility that you can do to serve, right? And then there's many ways to do it. And at the end, you know, you have a nice split of things that make you happy and like, you know, it's different. Like that's something that I really wanted to do.
Well, in my case, I was I lived in the US at the time, and the previous release managers were almost all in the US, and they actually reached out to me saying like, "Hey, would you like to do this?" And I'm pretty sure like the fact that I was in the right time zone ish, like, actually had something to do with them reaching out specifically to me saying like, you know, you could be doing this because I've been working on infrastructure at Facebook and like using Python for it and like, you know, talking a lot about this. And they're like, well, like looks like this is sort of similar to what we actually need from release management. So I considered it and like sounded fun to me. And then I moved back to Europe and they were like, well, so this is going to make it a little weirder for like talking to like the people who are doing like the macOS and Windows installers who are different people like on our team. Plus, like maybe if you do a release and it's like night in the US, like this is not going to work out. Like this is going to be weird. But at the time they already like agreed that this is going to be me. So I started doing it, but it turned out, you know what? Like actually it's fine. And ever since, you know, this is a little bit of a like, you know, bad pattern for diversity, but it turned out that all of the release managers so far are people in Europe. Yes. So like, you know, it was Pablo next, and then we had and Thomas, and now we have Hugo, all of us being in Europe. So maybe it's time to actually break that streak again. But, you know, kind of it just goes to show that there's some consideration coming into selection of our release manager. And maybe not all of them are like kind of risk that is realistic, because now we know after COVID that like work remotely and, you know, kind of working across time zones is perfectly reasonable. At the time, it wasn't so clear.
Do you have any release rituals? I heard that once the two of you threw a party on YouTube.
This is because I just want everybody to look like a clown, like I'm at the clown attractor. So at the time, basically the, one of the problems is that this process, even if the, you know, PEP 101 was there, it always feel like a bit mysterious, you know, like someone goes and makes a release and the release happened. And, you know, there is two things. One, I want to demystify this a bit. And the other thing is like, I want to show how hard is this, because it's like hours and very annoying. And also I hoped, and I don't know, you will tell me, but like, I hope that other people will see it and say, well, I can actually do this. You know, it's annoying, but it's not like rocket science, right? It's just like a lot of clicks at the time. So I was thinking about whether it was the best way. And the first time, I think beta 1 of 3.10, so I did like a stream on my own, which went well. A lot of people were saying, I think it's when we destroyed GitHub at the time. Nice. And then I thought, well, you know, like that is kind of cool, but like maintaining the stream at the same time you're doing it, and like all sorts of things can go wrong in the stream, right? I flashed the one of the API keys, well, you know, like a bunch of things. Yeah, not fantastic. So I talked with the people at Python Discord, and they really like the idea of like, you know, maintaining the stream and like inviting all the people of the Python Discord. And at that point I said like, well, I don't want this to be about me. So I said, well, you know, looking at how a person just clicks buttons and runs scripts is kind of like fun the first time, but like the
so
other
you
times.
You basically live streamed it.
Yeah, from start to. So I did one from beginning to end, like 4 hours or something. And people stick out there. So like, you know, that was amazing. But you know, I thought, well, the second time it's a bit different, but it's like, it's the same thing again, right? So I said, well, but I still would like to do it with more people. So at the time we said, okay, let's do this idea of a release party. And for the real release, like the 3.10 final release. So the idea was that meanwhile I was doing the release, so I invited a bunch of people. I think it was Carol, you, Irit. And the idea is that people, core developers, will talk about the features that they added. And they will explain a bit, like a mini conference, maybe like a mini presentations, and people could ask questions. And in the middle, people will like see how it's going. So it will cut basically from, you know, Wukas talking about typing to like how it's going in the release. And I was like, oh, everything is burning. And like, okay, good luck with that. And then like, you know, switching to something, and that worked really well. I think that worked really, really well. People really enjoyed it. And we did one more for 3.11. And then Thomas is a more serious person, and he's like not feeling like doing live stream, so like that's where it stopped. But yeah.
And is Hugo a more serious person, or is Hugo a party person?
I've not decided yet.
Not decided yet.
One of us.
Well, one of the little rituals that like I sort of like added to release management was that we have release notes, right? So that means if you go to the Python downloads page for a particular release, for a particular micro version, so 3.9.11 or whatever, like you're going to see this blurb of like, this is Python 3.9, this is the stage of its life cycle it's in, like those are the major changes there, like click here for the change log, or if there's security content, we're highlighted and say like, those are the security fixes there. And I felt like, okay, this is what needs to be there, but also there might be things that don't need to be there, but I would like there to be there. So for my releases 3.8 and 3.9, what I was doing before security releases, that nobody reads those release notes anymore, but for all the kind of alphas and betas and the final, like, big final release and then bug fixes, I would add, and now for something completely different, and just, you know, quotes from Monty Python sketches, because very many people, as we've seen just yesterday at the conference and on the quiz, don't even know that like Python comes from the Monty Python comedy group. So yeah, so I was adding like small snippets. Like I tried not to choose the most like controversial ones, and yet some people felt like I went a little far with some of the quotes, but you know, those were my releases. Well, like you know Monty Python, there's like Life of Brian, there's like Meaning of Life, like there was four seasons of the comedy show, so some of the sketches were like, you know, like pushing the envelope a bit, and some of them, let's just say, didn't age as well as others, right? So like I thought pretty careful about choosing the right ones, but it turns out, well, you know, kind of opinions differ. So for 310 and 311, you know, Pablo decided, okay, I'm gonna keep the section, but I'm gonna put something entirely different in it. And that actually is what the section name suggests. So like we kind of kept it, and every other release manager has kept the section but just put different things on there.
So you have different backgrounds. Pablo, you work for Bloomberg, which is a commercial entity. Lukasz, you're employed at the PSF, which is an American nonprofit. And Hugo, you work for the Sovereign Tech Funds, which is backed by the German government. Mm-hmm. Which of these models do you think is the most sustainable and the best for open source?
Like models, as in like.
Do we need more companies supporting open source, or do we need more nonprofits, or do we need more institutions and governments supporting open source for so people can do it as a part of their daily job and they don't have to do it only after work and on weekends?
What an interesting question, actually. I think it's just they are orthogonal, no? Like you probably, I mean, the boring answer is like you need everything, right? In the sense that, so obviously, like. To for big projects, and like for instance, right now we have several core developers in residence, right? Like those are people that the PSF pays, but that money normally comes from people that donate to this. And the nature of the at least American nonprofits is that when you donate money to the foundation, normally with some exceptions, you need to donate it to a project, like so for this thing, right? It's not just general thing that then the nonprofit administers, right? With some exceptions, but which means that you will need companies that wants to advance this, because like money doesn't appear from nowhere, right? And even like for salaries of people working full time and to be a competitive option, because they could say, well, you know, I could work for Python, and you know, if it's just donation from random members in the community, that's not only probably not going to be enough, but also like is very unsustainable in the sense that like what happens if, you know, people just, you know, one of the years like we just experienced, right? So you want someone who can commit a bit more from my, so we need these companies for sure, and it's important for us to have a good relationship with the companies, even if people don't like it. But also like it's important to have obviously the foundation that can administer the thing and can then have some control over like, okay, yes you want this and that, because you know, maybe you know the commercial entity wants this, but like, you know, what we have in mind is this kind of thing. Are you interested? So it kind of sets the goal and the direction. And then, you know, it's also very important to talk with like governments and like these kind of entities, because they are regulating a lot the market right now. For instance, Europe and America are heavily regulating open source in different ways and other things, like with, for instance, DORA and NIST. Those are security related things, and open source is impacted. Like for instance, right now everybody wants SBOMs, right? Which is like this bill of materials that contains how your software is built. And that is kind of a weird relationship, because it's work for us, right? But nobody pays us to do it, but they demand it somehow. And there is a weird unspoken relationship between all these entities together that needs to happen, because the companies consume they are bounded by the regulation. So when they consume open source, they need us to do it. So at the end, like if we say, for instance, well, we are not doing SBOMs, you know, because the German government doesn't have anything to say to us, but then the companies are not going to donate to us because they cannot use our software, right? So it's a weird kind of interdependency, and you need all the actors to be coordinated and understand every other point of view, because the government can say, well, you need this thing, like for tomorrow, like, well, how, right? So there is a conversation that needs to happen constantly between these entities.
What are your thoughts? Do you agree with everything said, or do you have different
view? Yeah, I think we do need a combination, because like open source, the whole point is that here's free software for you to use. And then everyone come to and use it for free, like all these companies. I mean, as they should, like we're saying, take this for free. But it's good that they should contribute back as well. But for some companies, it can be hard. Like, how do you contribute? Maybe you give money. That could be an easy way. But then who do you give the money to? You can give it to a foundation or something. But then there's lots of just solo developers. How will they get it? And maybe the money's not going to even help them because they just don't enjoy working on this anymore. So that's partly where the developers' residence and what I'm doing at the Sovereign Tech Agency. So we're maintaining it. So we can also do the kind of not so exciting jobs. So when you're working full time on it, you can have availability to, you know, to be there to respond when, for example, if someone has a problem on the CI, then I can maybe respond because I'm online. And also with the release management, actually, is very good because it can take quite a while for the release. And if something gets delayed, then it's like, it's okay. I don't need to juggle my day job about it because it is my day job.
Well, I agree with everything said. Essentially, the creation of a foundation that protects your trademark and actually allows for the community to grow in a healthful way and like provides the infrastructure for the project and so on, that is sort of separate. It is funded by, sponsored by, but it is separate from the corporate entities, allows for like a healthy independence. Right, like this actually means that even the companies contributing to the success of the PSF feel like there is a level playing field, that this is not a corporate project of a single company, which essentially also gives us a level of kind of trust in the fact that like we're going to be, by our ability to work on it full time, that we're not going to be steering it towards like interests of a single like multi-billion dollar corporation. Like what we are doing is like actually something that is like for the good of the project, for the good of the general user. Like, and there is very many kinds of users for Python. So this sort of disconnect between a company and the worker that who I am, for example, I think is pretty healthy. Like my work has been sponsored for multiple years now by Meta. I used to work for Facebook before that, but now like I can fully commit to working on Python, and I don't have to consider any, focuses or any like, you know, kind of priorities that Meta might have for Python in this current, quarter or half, like, or whatever. I don't need to think about Facebook shareholders right now. What I'm doing is I'm focusing on Python. And if they find that, okay, this is good enough of a job, like they sponsor me for the next year, and that's great. When I started this, a lot of people were saying, well, this is risky business, right? Because you're sponsored for a year and then they renew it for a year and then they renew it for a year. What if they don't renew it? But it turns out that in this current market that we have right now, like having like at least your work security for a single year could be worse, right? Like at least you know like that you're sort of like you can focus on your projects or whatever like for the next 12 months. And then we'll see.
Oh, we've seen recent layoffs in companies.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly right.
And if someone is interested in release management and would like to talk to the current release manager because their tools, for example, depend on Python or they're just curious, how can they contact you or how can they learn more?
They can, what can they do? I don't know. Contact us anywhere online, really. If they're your Python nerds, then come up to us. If we're at any other conferences as well.
There is also a web page. I don't remember the you search like release manager python.org, you will see it. There is a web page that in the python.org web that shows the every release manager, the email address that they want to be contacted at, and also you can see the different keys that we have used, although we are changing a bit then, hopefully in the future. But for instance, if you are running a distribution, you probably want the GPG keys just to ensure that the release and now is the six store, whatever. But a lot of people still use the GPG key. So
yeah, for older releases, though.
All right.
Yeah, for new releases, we don't use.
Okay. Yeah. Lucky you. Mm-hmm. Okay. I hit the GPG key, man. Like, I just hit it. It's like some stupid incantation. Okay. Anyway, so you can see it there, and you can see names and emails and maybe or maybe not GPG keys, you know?
And if someone is interested in C Python in general, what are some good ways to contribute and how to get started?
Come to the sprint next week, but and other conferences too, like PyCon US. Otherwise, have a look at the dev guide, which has kind of advice on getting started. Also watch Savannah's keynote from EuroPython. It's very good about how to get started.
Are there any other contributions except of code contributions? What if I can't write C, for example, if I could just write Python? Are contributions welcome as well?
Yeah, definitely. Like I don't do much C nowadays. So, I mean, there's a lot of Python in Python and documentation. And this is a very big project, so it touches a lot of ground.
And if people would like to find you on the internet, where are you? Everywhere. You also have a podcast, right?
We do have a established podcast, which is, in fact, about core Python development. So if you're interested in that and you don't want to listen to podcasts like at 1.5 speed, because Pablo already talks at 1.5 speed naturally, that's how he's made, you can listen to core.py. It's available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and you know there's an RSS, so you can use whatever client that you want for that. Our cadence is a little spotty, but like we arrive at like 24 episodes for now. So if you want like insight on a particular piece, we're always having a different subject matter for like every episode. Yeah, like that's the we would be happy if you listen.
Apart from the podcast, social media?
Yeah, Mastodon, Blue Sky, Cooper VK.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks.
Thank you.